afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duvernay are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. And Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cowder Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Good afternoon, Neil. How are you doing today?
Good. How was your weekend?
My weekend was fabulous. How about yours?
Well, it's good because it's not like it was 2 weeks ago when it was 150 degrees here.
Oh, my goodness. It was 103 at my house.
But I'm really upset because when I moved here 18 and a half years ago, my broker said, this is such an exclusive community. It never gets above 72.
Are you demanding a refund?
I am. It was misrepresentation.
I agreed. Well, before we jump into the articles, let's introduce our guest, Bill McFadden, who's the founder and publisher of NewsHawk.com. So don't leave us quite yet. We're going to do our normal articles, and then we'll be speaking with Bill.
Okay, just one correction. This article, the first article we have, is not normal, because for the first time...
Because you found it.
No. The first time, this is actually from the editorial page of the New York Times.
Oh, that is rare,
So this, but it's from a very good columnist, David Leonhardt. And what this article, which was in yesterday's New York Times, talks about is sort of the irony of what the traditional Republican orthodoxy has been for the last 40 years, that high tax rate is a disincentive to growth, and low tax rates incentivize people to work harder. And what he does is he takes a look at George Romney, the father, who was president of American Motors back in 1961-62. And at that time, he was the most highly paid corporate executive in America. And his salary was $230,000. Now, the corporate tax rate at that time was 90%. And when asked about a raise, he said, I don't want a raise. My focus is now not so much on money. I have enough money. I make, $200,000 a year, which is enough. And he talked, like other executives talked, about stakeholders that made a difference, not just shareholders, whether it was his customers, the society as a whole. And what Leonhardt says is over the next 45 years, as tax rates began to come down, there became a greater incentive for people to take more salary. So in 1962, he says it was easy for Romney to say, I don't want any more salary. He'd only keep 10%. But when tax rates were reduced down to 70, 60, 50, 40, now 37%, all of a sudden, salary became much more attractive because you retain more. So the culture became one in which you wanted a higher salary if you were an executive as opposed to doing, quote unquote, the right thing. And finally, the whole notion of trickle down doesn't work because you can just look at the disparity in wealth. And so what happened was the culture of American business became one of maximizing your own wealth at the expense of everybody else.
So, well, I think it's important, though, to also point out that $250,000 then was a large sum of money. It's not what $250,000 is today.
Well, in the article, he actually adjusts for that and says that today would be $2 million.
Right, so, which is in line with what executives are being paid today.
Well, not exactly. I mean, first of all, hedge fund guys make, $500-600 million a year.
Hedge funds weren't even invented at that point.
Okay, but corporate executives make, $10, $15, $20, $30 million. And, $2 million is not, and he was the highest paid.
That's true.
Anyway, the point is that the whole idea that the high tax rate is a disincentive to entrepreneurship is really nonsense based on this analysis. And the growing inequality in an ironic way could be attributed to lower tax rates. So this is just a different way of looking at the general view. You hear people on TV today saying, we are going to change taxes because we're lower taxes because it's pro-growth. And, it may not be so pro-growth. The next article is from the Wall Street Journal. And I find this particularly interesting because it talks about black swans. Now, a black swan, for those of you who haven't read Black Swan by Nicholas Taleb, are events that come about beyond what is expected. In a system where you have what's called the normal distribution of probabilities, there are events that are extreme, but they very rarely happen. And in the last 25 years, there have been what's called 25 standard deviation events, which is way without precedent. They're supposed to take place once every 100 million years, and they're taking place much more rapidly. So what happened in the last 5 years, based on this article, is that a bunch of funds got together and said they were going to create black swan funds, funds that would be designed to capture these extreme views.
What's interesting about these funds that's come out on a specific instance like a black swan instance, it usually guarantees that they're not going to happen again.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And so it's one of those, it's funny and ironic how that happens.
Well, because and you're exactly right. And these funds have done so badly, some of them are closing now, because by definition, a black swan is something you don't expect. And in fact, the funds that were created to essentially take advantage of Nicholas Taleb's work missed the whole point of his work. His work was to position yourself so you can take advantage of black swans, but not to be invested in expectations that you base on your own analysis, because you can't. And so what he said is he said create a barbell strategy, meaning that you put 90% of your money in very, very low volatility investments, and then take 5 or 10% of your money and put them in speculative possible black swan events. And what these funds did is put all their money in possibility of black swans, and it didn't work out very well for them.
No, and investors have a short time horizon where they're willing to wait around for that return.
Next article, it talks about robo-advisors. And the headline in this Wall Street Journal article is, "Your robo-advisor is more active than you think." And if you ask the person on the street what a robo-investment is, they would think it's essentially a computerized investment strategy that takes advantage of, you know, market swings without having to be influenced by the hand of a investor who believes
a human, basically, with emotions.
Good word, human.
You forgot what we were.
Well, you know, in the investment business, human is a rarity. I was on Wall Street, and I can attest to that. By the way, one of the funniest Wall Street stories I heard was in Michael. What's his name? The great writer who writes all these Wall Street books, Michael Lewis. His first book, he tells a story at Salomon Brothers in the early 90s when one of the trading partners saw his friend walking out the door, and he said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm flying to Chicago." He said, "You know, I feel lucky today. Here's $10. Take out an insurance policy in case the plane crashes." So that's sort of, you know.
that's really human, huh?
But what they talk about here is that there is a hand, because the algorithms that manage these robo funds are created by investment managers, and they compared Vanguard, Betterment, and Wealthfront, and they found, you know, major differences in the basic portfolio, to say nothing of the algorithm that would manage those portfolios. So when you buy a robo fund, you are buying, to some extent, the belief among the managers of that fund that they can beat the market.
True, and you know, I think robo advisor is a misnomer, given that it's exactly that. There's no personal touch. There's no human touch in terms of with advising on issues other than just a portfolio.
Yeah, and I think
I think financial planning and your financial life goes far beyond just what your investments are.
I know. I love that commercial where the investor is on the phone and he has a knife to his stomach and he's saying, "So I cut right here." He's talking to his doctor.
Right.
You know, and I'm thinking, you know, I should be an investment person because I have all these computer things that I get from my Fidelity account, and therefore I don't need an expert.
Right.
Yeah. So do you think I should become my own doctor?
No, Neil, because having you on the planet makes the planet better.
Well, I still have a therapist, by the way.
as that, you should continue to go
as
to.
So you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
And last week when Kelly was on, Kelly Marsh from Cornerstone, it was great to hear about that they can pre-approve you for a home loan and have your offer be like cash. I was really impressed with that.
It was so good. I'm thinking of buying a house.
Great. Can I live in it when you're done buying it? Anywho, we're in the studio today. We're thrilled to have Bill McFadden, the founder and publisher of NewsHawk.com, with us. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And so, you know, we wanted to have you on today because we wanted to talk about the business of news. And how did you come about with the idea for NewsHawk, which has become such a vital part of our Santa Barbara community? I know myself, I go there to check out what's going on every day. And if I hear something, I go to try to verify that it's actually happening. So how did NewsHawk, how'd the idea come to you?
Good question. First, I want to congratulate you on describing it accurately. It's the business of news. It's not the news business. We have to make a profit. That's all of our NewsHawk team members know that, whether they're on the reporting side or the business side, they all know that we're in a business to succeed. NewsHawk came about in 2006. I'd had a weekly newspaper, and to this day, it's beloved in this town. We won a lot of awards, never made a dime, and had to shut it down. And then I was looking at other publishing opportunities when in 2006 there were some local circumstances that created a void of local news in Santa Barbara, and I knew readers were online looking for places to go to get local news, and they're not being able to find it. And so I wondered if businesses were quite at that point yet, and it turned out enough of them were. So I convinced a few of them to commit to advertising for a year, and I convinced a few of those to prepay. That provided the seed funding to get NewsHawk started, and here we are. We'll be 10 next month.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah. 10-year like
anniversary. Yeah, probably feels like more like 30,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, if you ask Missy, definitely.
Before you started, was your beard gray?
I don't know about that, but I had hair up here.
So. Well, and just for all of our listeners out there, you still have hair up top, Bill. At least from where I sit.
I'm taller than you. That's
exactly
why.
You're taller than me. So now let's talk a little bit about NewsHawk's business model. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's not a charity. So you have to create enough income that you're paying your staff, you're making a profit. What does that look like?
That's a good question. No, if you talk to my wife, she has a different opinion on this. But NewsHawk's business model is advertising and sponsorship based, and then we actually have a large number of readers who just send us money to because they want to reward us. They like what we're doing. They don't have anything to advertise. They just want to support NewsHawk. So,
and that's the Hawks Club.
The Hawks Club.
So, yeah, because I have seen that where you can go online and you can make a donation, a one-time or a monthly reoccurring. So how many people actually do that? That's kind of awesome.
Well, I had the idea in the beginning. Had about 8 people ask me if they could just give me money. And I thought, well, if there's 8 people out there, maybe there's 800 people. It turns out there's not 800 people, or at least I don't know them yet. But it's pretty close. And so that's encouraging. And I think as we continue to grow and the online model continues to evolve, I think readers will become more and more part of that. Personally, I believe, based on my children who are all adults, that generation, the millennials, believe that everything online should be free. And whether you agree or disagree, you can't deny that they have quite a lot of power going forward. So I think you have to accept that as a mindset and figure out ways to work around that. So that's kind of what we're doing. So we don't believe in paywalls. We want to give people the opportunity to pay us, but we're not going to require it.
And your editorial view is essentially neutral. And so that makes it easier for people to contribute because it's not a a politicized vehicle.
That's a really good point. We made a decision early on to not make political endorsements or take positions. And the reason for that is, you know, it would be me doing all of that. We have a very small staff. We don't have an independent editorial board. And the truth of the matter is nobody does. Even the, you know, at the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal level, they do have independent editorial boards that can help them create and craft positions. But most news organizations in this country, especially in small towns like ours, don't have that.
Yeah, but the New York Times and is our president said it's fake news, so that you can't use that as an example.
Well, I don't know that he'd say that about the Wall Street Journal, but the Wall Street Journal does have an editorial board. So
let's talk about that fake news. So, you know, gosh, it's been the last whatever this election cycle, which seems like it's been endless. Talk about fake news and a lot of stuff online you're seeing that is so egregious one way or the other that, you know, at least a thinking person thinks, God, that can't be true, right? So what do you think about this fake news, kind of where we're headed and what's going on in the news business?
Sure. Well, if it's on the internet, it's got to be true. but the, because it's all robo, right? I don't think we have enough time to really get into it, but fake news has always been around. I mean, fake news, you know, Benjamin Franklin was a pretty good practitioner of that, and Walter Duranty during the early stages of the Cold War, you know, that was a significant fake news thing.
And we used to call it propaganda news, right?
Yeah, there's a lot of different names for it. But it's certainly in the age of the internet when anybody has access to anything, it certainly makes it easier to come up with things and sort of create a momentum behind those that you know, perception then becomes reality. Well, I did read it, and it was picked up by this organization. There's a shred of truth to
right.
it. So it's good enough for me. And it you know, mischaracterizes my opponent. So it's always a risk. But I think at the national level, there are ways to combat that. Because if whether you're on the left or the right, you have 1,000 different sources that you trust that you can go to get the real story. You don't have to abide by that fake news. But I think at a local level, where we've seen the contraction in the journalism industry. You know, newspapers are going out of business, laying off staff. Nobody has the resources that they did 20 to 25 years ago. I think it's a real risk, not so much fake news, but what news is not being covered. And in a small town like this, not that city officials and city councils and politicians are nefarious or have, you know, any kind of interest, but the public's best interest at heart, if they're not being held accountable, then you're really in a situation where you can actually wake up one day and there's something that was rammed through that you had no idea about. So it's not necessarily fake news, it's just not being covered. Or it's a situation where you cannot trust the local news media to cover something fairly and you don't have an alternative. You know, if you don't trust the Washington Post, you have the New York Times or the LA Times or the Wall Street Journal or ABC News that you can trust. But if you're in a small town like ours and you don't have an organization you can trust, that's a real problem.
Right.
And you don't have an option.
And there has been a void, you know, because you think about what other newspapers are out there. You have a weekly newspaper that's basically more about arts and culture than really mm-hmm. hardcore news. Then you have, you know, a larger paper that, you know, circulation is down tremendously. And so it really created that niche for you. Now, when you talk about the advertising model of your mm-hmm. business model, how is that going? Because in the early days of the internet, that was the monetization model of you'd sell advertising and it would pay for everything.
Right.
But it seems that it has gone into a much more niched marketing, you know, pay to play, basically. They want more results. How does that work for you?
Well, it does work for us, and we are sustainable and profitable. And again, Missy,
congratulations
thank
on
you.
That. That's not
Missy
an easy
would
feat
disagree,
here.
But,
hey, she's not in the room. Missy's his wife,
right.
in case you're listening.
You know, we have the numbers to prove it because it's on the internet. but the advertising, you know, technology really is NewsHawk's biggest competitor because it's constantly changing. I mean, what works today, you know, who knows if it's going to work in 3 years? Truthfully, nobody does. And so what we end up doing is, but we have a lot more flexibility and we're more nimble on the web. We don't have infrastructure to defend. So if something's not working or starting to slow down, we just figure out a way to recalibrate and then keep moving forward. But I think, again, in a small town where we've built up a trust and a relationship and an engagement with our readers, we have a credibility that they understand, you know, they need to support NewsHawk. And whether that's monetarily or, you know, rewarding the advertisers who are supporting us, they understand that. They get that. Because if NewsHawk's not here, what's their alternative? And that's not a very pretty picture.
And, you know, it's interesting. If you look at local news, local TV news here, it's 22 minutes. The rest is commercials. And of the 22 minutes, a good part of it is either national packages or economic news that is basically a macroeconomic view. There's not that much local news, but there is because I think you need in-depth reporting to sort of mine those stories. You know, it's easy to cover a murder or a car accident. It's tougher to do a piece that requires some intellect.
It is very tough. And, you know, even covering the Board of Supervisors, you know, that can be a grueling 4-hour process, and you're parking a reporter there for 4 hours, and you know, it's maybe a 3.5-minute burst of activity that they have to be there for. That's the crux of that whole day, but you gotta have them there because you don't know when that burst is going to come, and so it then becomes, you know, a real choice when you're trying to allocate where your resources are going. That's where we do have an advantage because we know our readers are telling us every minute of every hour of every day what they want to read. And so we know when we're being asked to cover something or a reporter making a reporter assignment, we know, okay, if we cover this, we can get 5,000 reads by the end of the day. If we go over here and cover this, we can maybe get 500 reads in 2 days.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we're in studio today with Bill McFadden, the founder and publisher of NewsHawk.com, and he was also named the Entrepreneur of the Year in 2008 by both the Goleta Valley Chamber of Commerce and the Santa Barbara Technology and Industry Association. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, I think that that's a good vote saying that you're doing something right.
But you know what? But I do have to compliment you in that there are sometimes I'll be with friends and they'll say, "Did you read the LA Times, this story?" And, you know, some of us like me would say, "No, I don't read the LA Times." But when anybody says, "I saw it on NewsHawk," everyone says, "Oh, yeah, I saw it on NewsHawk too." So in terms of, you know, impact, everyone reads NewsHawk.
We have a really good staff, and I do a pretty good job staying out of the way.
And so, you know, before the break, you were talking about, you know, having to make those tough allocation calls for resources based upon what you think the readership is.
Right.
Where does it come into, even though the sensational, you know, crazy story over here will get the most clicks, you know, you really believe that the readers need to know whatever boring thing that's going on at City Hall, right?
Right.
So how do you manage that, and how do you balance that those choices?
I don't. Tom Bolton, our executive editor, does. We have a number of stories that we call "Eat Your Vegetable" stories. That you know, we consider ourselves a news organization of record for Santa Barbara County. So if 5 years from now somebody needs to find out what happened at a particular meeting, we feel like they need to have that opportunity to find that on NewsHawk. So we do cover a lot of those stories, but we basically there are stories that you need an independent professional journalist to cover and, you know, provide context for, to kind of dig into and take apart and put back together for the readers. And then, but most of what happens in a small town like ours, you don't need a professional independent reporter to tell you. You know, you see something or know about something, and you tell your spouse or a friend, and in a two-paragraph conversation, you've told them everything they need to know about that. And that's good enough for them for that particular issue. So what we do is we tell the community, look, we know you're out there sharing information with other people. While you're doing that, share it with us. So particularly service clubs and nonprofit groups figured out early on that they can share that, provide that information.
You are a great source for press releases.
Exactly, because if you think about it, what we call fossil media doesn't have the space or the time to cover that. For us, the internet's free and unlimited. It's a management issue. So we're happy to have that. Our readers are always looking for something else to read while they're on our site. And so if we can provide that, it's a win-win for everybody.
And so based upon what you were talking about, you know, resources and where you need a seasoned reporter, let's delve into your newest venture, which I'm really excited about, the Reimagine Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about it.
So every year we try to do three or four special projects because, Neil, you had mentioned the investigative reporting. NewsHawk doesn't have the resources or the time or the manpower or woman power to, you know, do any kind of sustained investigative reporting. But what we do is we, three or four times a year, we come up with a topic and we figure, okay, you know, let's try to go out and get some sponsors specific for this particular topic that will pay for us to, you know, hire some freelance writers to fill in doing daily stuff so we can free up our reporters to do nothing but a topic for a week or 2 weeks. That's our commitment to investigative journalism or more in-depth journalism. And so the project that we're going to be working on this fall, one of them is Reimagine Santa Barbara. And as many of your listeners know, and certainly almost all of our readers know, Santa Barbara's downtown has really had a tough go here in the last year or so. And there's a lot of issues. There's a lot of misperception. There's a lot of opportunity. And so we're going to be making sense of that. And in a four-part series, we're going to look at the history of downtown, how it developed from the Presidio and Mission days to today. If, for instance, if we were designing a downtown today, it would look nothing like 15 blocks long and a block wide. I mean, that nobody would do that. But there are reasons why it developed that way. Then we're going to look at everything that's happening downtown today, good and bad. And there are a lot of success stories that don't get the publicity. And then we're also going to look at some other communities like San Luis Obispo, Ventura, Old Town, Pasadena, Santa Monica, and Boulder, Colorado, where they've had revitalization. In Boulder's case, they've got a really thriving high-tech entrepreneurial downtown that the city is really behind and supporting. Old Town, Pasadena is a huge success from the retail and housing standpoints. So there's other areas in the country that we think, have some opportunity for us and are good examples. And then the fourth part will be asking our readers to help us identify priority issues and what Santa Barbara could become 50 years from now or even 100 years from now. You know, who today is going to be the next Pearl Chase that's going to have that vision that says, okay, if we do this today, we can create something that's going to be really spectacular decades from now after we're all living at the Santa Barbara Cemetery. And so the idea for that would be that our readers will help us identify five or six priorities. And then in the first quarter of next year, we're working with our partner, Shared Mission Santa Barbara, and they're going to put on a public forum and then a hackathon to try to get the right people in the room to take those priorities and say, okay, if we want to implement them in 5 years, these are the things that we need to do to get that done.
And when you list the success stories, whether it's Boulder, Colorado, you can also put in the Funk Zone, because there is success here that shows that if you spread out and put it like a square, mm-hmm. and you put something that's attractive, you can actually get people to come and have a good time. So there is some empirical evidence to support the notion that we can reinvent ourselves because we've already been doing it.
That's a really great example. And the Funk Zone now, you know, if you go out to State Street and consider Moxie, which is just busy all day long.
It's a great, if you haven't been, it's a great place for kids, for adults. I actually want to go without my kids. I'm going on the 23rd of September for their fundraiser, so I can go without my kids.
Yeah, I mean, it's just an astonishing thing. And then, you know, you have the Reagan Center, you have the Maritime Museum that's not very far away. So you've got that whole West Beach Funk Zone area that's you could spend all day there.
Well, and with all that new
and night.
All that new commercial space mm-hmm. coming online between, you know, the train station and the pier,
right.
You basically have quite a few more vacancies that we're going to need to try to fill.
Yes. Yes.
And so it will be interesting to see how that all plays out.
And from a tourism perspective, how are you going to get them to go under the freeway up to State Street as opposed to just spending all day down, you know, below the freeway?
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara, and Diane Duva's Sport Arena.
That's right. You know, I had a horrible game last time I played. You know, it's bocce is one of those things. It's hit or miss, hit or miss.
Well, you're wearing your bocce jacket, I see.
No, I was not. I have a bocce hat, but I don't wear it because, you know, vanity plays in. So what can I say? But anyway, if you're just joining us, it's not about bocce, Neil.
But does Newshawk have a sports writer?
We do.
Because they should cover the bocce.
The Arnaldi's bocce tournament.
I'll get Barry on that.
It gets pretty...
We've written about it before.
Some people take it pretty seriously.
I know.
But I do have to say Arlington has a team, and we a winter league, and we're... Two winter season league champions in a row. So everyone's out to get us now. You didn't know this
exciting thing
about Arlington Financial Advisors.
No, we'll have to resurrect that Santa Barbara club team.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're just joining us, Bill McFadden's here telling us about the business of news with Newshawk.com. He's the founder and publisher. And so we were talking before the break about his special report that he's doing this year called Reimagine Santa Barbara, really talking about the downtown area and how we can revitalize it. And I think an important point, if you're joining us and you're interested in this topic, there are sponsorship opportunities because without your assistance, it's hard to get this financial, financial news off the ground.
Exactly.
So tell us, so you envision Reimagine Santa Barbara actually going into 2018 as well?
We do, and then we partner often with Pepperdine University's School of Public Policy, and they're actually interested in taking this a little bit further, which I'm kind of interested in, because then it could be like a 3 or 4 or 5 year project instead of just a 1 year or 2 year mm-hmm. thing. So we do have a lot of opportunities, and we have a lot of expectations for this, but it's an exciting project, and the truth of the matter is it can't be finished in a year. It's going to take us as a community time to develop that. If you are interested in sponsoring, you can certainly contact me. We've got all different levels. What we are trying to do, and as you can see in our levels, is we want a broad cross-section of the community behind this, because really, if we're going to make an impact in downtown Santa Barbara, it's got to be the entire community participating.
And how involved is the political community here in Santa Barbara with the project? Have you talked to them about it yet?
I've talked to some of them, and we're still in the
early stages this
week, so I've got to...
This is breaking news on Money Talk.
Dialing for dollars and picking pockets over the next couple of weeks.
Beyond the politicians, I found, as a newcomer, only 19 years here, that there is a...
Well, you want to know what, no matter what level you're at, you're still going to be a newcomer until you lose the accent.
I didn't lose the accent.
You know, Bill Cerrone. Peter McDougal.
Yeah, Peter McDougal. He might be a local.
Wait, Peter McDougal's from New York also?
No, from Boston.
I'm joking.
Actually, Rhode Island.
Yeah. So the thing I learned about Santa Barbara that I was surprised about, it's in a way, it's a provincial town. And so whatever the politicians want, there seems to be... an underlying sense that people actually like it here, and that when you want change that everyone thinks is a natural, we need more housing, we need more business, we need better retail. When you propose something that would actually get you there, people resist. Mm-hmm. You know, you just look today, in the last few days, there are still, architectural review boards and planning commissions that are saying, you know, no to a new project because the height of the parapet wall is 2.5 inches off center, you know, and that people can't live here. So there's this sense that beyond politicians, you know, what do the people here really want?
Well, nobody's really asked that question. And if you think about it, and, you know, far be it for me to besmirch Pearl Chase and Dwight Murphy, but they didn't really have a broad community conversation when they were implementing those reforms. Arguably, they did a great job for Santa Barbara, and who among us could dispute that? But, you know, that was kind of a closed clique that sort of developed that plan and put it into action. And so,
unfortunately, we all reap the benefits of that open space by the ocean, you know, the parks.
Which is unique in California, that
Absolutely. Open
space, or largely unique. What I think is necessary this day and age is really to have to get as many people in this community involved as possible. And I think there's a lot of power there, and I think we can really make a difference. It's exciting.
Yes, it is very exciting, and thank you for taking that on, because it is a real, you know, pressing issue that's facing our community that touches each and every one of the citizens of our community.
It really does. It's our most visible neighborhood, and it needs some TLC.
Absolutely. And so, you know, as I was talking to a bunch of people about you coming on the show, you know, a lot of the younger people said, well, you know, ask them, what advice do you have to someone that's looking to go into journalism today? Because it's definitely a different animal than it was when you embarked on it.
It's nothing like what I had imagined. I would say make sure you learn how to do math and then don't get into journalism. that's why I'm here. In the fact that I couldn't hit a curveball, but I think there's a lot of opportunity in journalism today. It's nothing like when I started 35, 40 years ago. The jobs are still there, the tasks are still there. They're just not in a tidy box where you get hired by one company and you stay there for 40 years and then retire. Everything is splintered, and so you have to go hunting for those opportunities. So I think it's really important to develop an understanding of how to be an entrepreneur, because whether you're actually going to use that for business or for your own career goals, that in journalism especially is how you're going to survive and actually thrive. So I would say that's probably the number one frustration I have with journalism schools today. When I go to talk to them, there's just this idea that they're going to get a job at the New York Times and they're going to work their way up to the editor and then the publisher and they're going to stay there their entire career. And that's just not practical. It's just not ever going to happen. Those days are long gone. So you got to be an entrepreneur.
That's an interesting take, which many of them, I'm sure, are surprised to hear when you speak to them.
I wish I'd have known. I mean, in college, I majored in journalism and didn't take any economics classes or entrepreneurialism. I don't think anybody even knew how to spell back then. You know, you only took economics classes or business classes if you were actually going to be a business reporter. Otherwise, you stayed as far away from those things as you could.
Right, because you're drawn to it because you're a creative writer.
Because you can't do math.
One of the exceptions to this rule is my son, who just celebrated his 20th year at the same network. And
wow, that's unusual.
Yeah, and he got his Mickey Mouse statue. Every 5 years, you get a different reward. I wonder if it was worth 20 years to get a
Mickey Mouse statue.
Yeah, but there are, you know. But he said, like, he's been there longer probably than almost anybody, because there is it's almost like working used to be when I was on Wall Street, getting a head in a bank. You had to go to like 7 different countries, and in the TV business, the news business, you look at people. You know, they go to a small place and mm-hmm. they go to a bigger place, and then you know they get a job where they can do some TV, and then they go back to a bigger newspaper because they were on TV. There's really sort of like a whole routine now that you have to go through. And by the time you get to the point where you've actually earned your stripes, you're too old and you're not camera ready anymore. So,
It's kind of like professional sports without the salaries. But, you know, very few people, very few percentages of, you know, high school athletes make it to college. Fewer of those make it to the pros. So the same thing in journalism.
And that's why the future is radio. you're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment. Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence. What happens when an entity walks into your office?
Well, entities are all drawn back to people.
Oh, I thought
humans. It's back to humans.
Back to humans.
Bringing it full circle, humans.
Okay, so I'm an entity also?
No, you're a human. Well, it depends.
If I have more than one person.
Anywho, we're in studio with Bill McFadden, the founder and publisher of NewsHawk.com, and we're just talking about the news industry. And so, you know, how do you think that this it's an industry in flux at this point? I would say
yes.
And where do you see it playing out? And I know that's a kind of a large, huge question for our last segment, but and is it sustainable?
Well, as I said, NewsHawk's model is sustainable. For the industry, I think it's probably sustainable. I mean, I suspect it is, but I think the jury's still very much out on that. But the kind of disruption and turmoil that we're going through today, you know, is probably no different from what happened at the advent of TV, the advent of radio, the advent of the telegraph, or probably even the printing press. You know, people thought, oh my God, this is going to be the end of everything that we know. And there was a lot of probably disruption during those periods. And then eventually people got used to it. And then as more people accepted it, standards rose and the quality improved. And I think we'll see that with the internet. The difference, I think, with the internet is it's so pervasive and available to anybody. You know, back in the TV early days, it wasn't available to everybody. That's different now. And so it's probably going to be more tumultuous for a longer period of time. But at some point, we've seen that in Santa Barbara, where blogs pop up and, you know, people have access to technology and suddenly they can all be their own reporters. And for a while, it's kind of cool because you sort of know things that nobody else does. But then after a while, you realize, well, I've got a full-time job and I've got a family and I don't have time to be a reporter. It's hard. And truthfully, it's not that interesting.
But, you know, there's another side.
It.
There's the mirror image of this. You can look at it from the reporter side, but from the societal standpoint, you have like this animization of society now because you've got, in a sense, two separate media presentations that people look at. And there was this incredible piece I saw about a month ago where they interviewed 10 people from both political spectrums. And some of the people read the Washington Post and the New York Times. The others listened just to Fox and Breitbart. But they didn't cross over.
Right.
So one of the responsibilities of news today is not simply to provide information, but to make sure, if they really care about this country, to provide some semblance of truth. Because one of the real, I think, divisive aspects of the society has been exacerbated by the divisiveness of the press. And where you are able to take people's worst instincts or best instincts, depending upon what your point of view is, and make people believe what they think is right. And there's a responsibility there.
There is a responsibility. And I think the press has been sort of, you know, gone down this path as well. And I'm certainly not going to apologize for them or defend that. But I think at some point, readers and listeners, and it's not enough. You know, news is and information are like a narcotic. You want more and more and more. And I think, you know, this tribalization that we seem to have today, you know, that'll probably carry along for a few years. But at some point, even the most committed people are going to say, you know, there's got to be more to this. And then at that point, they're going to start to look for more. And if they can't find it, they're going to demand it. And so I think at that point, journalists and journalism entities, if you will, if they're smart, will require of themselves higher standards and the industry as well. Because what's happening today is not sustainable. This is, You know, it's just too much chaos, and that's not healthy for anything. But I think there are ways that we can rise above that, and NewsHawk certainly has tried to do that. I mean, you know, editorially, by not taking positions, we've tried to make NewsHawk's content be a safe space for people to just go and get news, find out what's happening in their town, and, you know, arm them with the information that they need to make their own wise decisions.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for the opportunity.
And thank you for providing us NewsHawk, particularly those few occasions when my picture has been on on the web. I appreciate that. You've been listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be back here next week.